Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Yanger. This is a certified case. Counsel for the government, you may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Efron, Judges of the Court, may it please the Court. I am Lieutenant Commander Kucholsky, and I am Commander McCleary, represent the United States. As you previously notified the timekeeper, I request to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
It's granted.
The Coast Guard Court erred when it set aside Petty Officer Yanger's conviction for involuntary manslaughter. Petty Officer Yanger pled guilty, and his pleas were provident. I'd like to discuss three possible rationales for the Coast Guard Court's error, any one of which would be cause for reversal by this court. First is a failure by the Coast Guard Court to articulate the proper legal standard and a reliance upon a rationale that this court has previously overruled. The second is that even if the proper standard were used, the quantum of conflict that the Coast Guard Court found was not a substantial basis that this court had required to overturn guilty plea. And third, even if the military judge had committed error, setting aside the conviction is inappropriate because self-defense was unavailable. First, the Coast Guard Court never articulated the legal standard it used to overturn the plea. It relied on the discussion to RCM 910 subparagraph echo, where it talks about any potential defense. I believe that equates to the difference between the substantial basis that this court has required to overturn a guilty plea in United States versus Prater and in subsequent cases. And the potential defense, it aligns more with the mere possibility of conflict standard that this court explicitly overruled in United States versus Logan. It's important to note that the Coast Guard Court failed to articulate that standard because of the historical evolution of the law in this area. It started off with the plain language of Article 45 of the UCMJ and the, as I mentioned, comments to RCM 910 subparagraph echo. By a strict textual interpretation of RCM 910 echo, whether any potential defense was raised, and its failure to then articulate the subsequent modifying case law, as in United States versus Prater, where this court had required a substantial conflict with the accused pleas, the Coast Guard Court erred. It's important to understand the presumptions upon which these two tests were based. The substantial basis test was called the more realistic test because in virtually any case, there is always the mere possibility of a defense, and counsel may choose not to raise certain defenses for tactical advantage or to limit the information which the finder of fact may have in order to insulate his client from misconduct or to mitigate some of the issues for the subsequent sentencing. In the old mere possibility of conflict standard, the defenses sort of lurk below the surface and that they could be raised by any artful or unhelpful comment that the accused made during the course of the inquiry, even against perhaps the express wishes of the accused, which is what we had here.
Counsel, my colleagues may have some further questions about the history of the of this provision and our substantial basis test, and I don't want to cut off your argument if that's where you want to focus your attention, but perhaps you might want to turn to the substantial basis test and advise the court whether or not that test was met here in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Your Honor, the Coast Guard Court seized on the phrase "with the glass" as the quantum of conflict that it called the substantial conflict that this court has required in order to set aside a guilty plea. Our primary assertion and sort of underlaying the historical concept in the center of the
court. This is reference to, I just wandered her out of my face with the glass.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just want to make sure we're in the same place.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe in the joint appendix on page 32.
Is it your view that that's the CCA's sole basis and pivot on which they felt that the self-defense was in play?
Yes, Your Honor. You see throughout the course of the record, the stipulation of fact that was agreed to by the accused prior to trial, the inquiry that the judge conducted along with the stipulation of fact, that all the other statements were consistent with the fact that the accused believed he did not feel threatened, he was not scared, he explicitly denied that the defense of self-defense applied.
What about the CCA's assertion that that his denials were ambiguous?
Well, Your Honor, that goes back to the concept of this substantial basis. There are perhaps...
Were they ambiguous?
I'm sorry, sir?
Were they ambiguous?
Well, he said that, I don't believe it was ambiguous. He said, I wanted her out of my face with the glass. That could have been a rational...
Well, I thought the CCA was referring to his denials he was scared, denial that, you know, that was ambiguous.
Yes, Your Honor. The judge immediately followed up that comment with the questions, did you feel threatened? No, sir. Did you feel scared? No, sir. I believe that, and this court has said in United States versus Johnson, that the accused often try to rationalize their behavior. And we see from the accused's unsworn statement, also included in the joint appendix, that he obviously felt remorse, that at that point that he was providing some sort of rationalization rather than trying to raise some unarticulated fear or unarticulated invocation of the right of self-defense. And that actually goes back to, as I started to mention, the historical reason. We believe that...
Where in the record does it reflect that the answers were ambiguous?
I don't believe they were ambiguous, Your Honor.
I thought you were just conceding that.
No, sir, I don't believe they were ambiguous. And if I give the impression of a concession...
So the CCA got that part wrong.
Yes.
So the only indication in the record, as far as the government is concerned, that might possibly give rise to the inference of self-defense is that I just wanted her out of my face because she hit the glass or whatever that was.
Yes, sir. With the glass.
What use are we able to make of the facts related to the military judge in the stipulation of fact?
Well, the facts themselves show that self-defense would not have been available even if the judge had gone further and explained it. And there's a number of reasons there, drawing primarily on this court's decision in United States versus Smith. The accused was a mutual combatant. He was seated in the relative safety of the vehicle as the victim was outside, and it was only when she threatened, and I use that word.
Well, it says in the stipulation of fact, paragraph 26, Ms. Carter was not observed pointing, jabbing, or threatening the EM3 anger with remains of the stemware.
That's true, Your Honor. She never manifested any intent to assault the accused. Part of the self-defense test, there's an objective element and a subjective element. Here, the questions about whether he felt threatened, whether he felt scared, go to the subjective part of that test, and if the accused is not willing to say he subjectively felt that he was in fear of offensive bodily contact, that he felt that the victim was about to commit an assault upon him, the subjective element isn't met. And here we also have his further comment in regards to the gesticulation with the glass in the victim's hand that he characterizes his body language. There's explicit denials that she was poking or jabbing or threatening him with it in any way, and even he characterized it as body language, which goes along with this notion that he didn't feel threatened or scared. And then the objective test, he was a mutual combatant. He left the relative safety of the vehicle to engage the victim. while she had this broken stemware in her hand, she knew, he knew that she had it. There was no escalation on her part by having that in her hand. He failed to withdraw after the initial aggression. We see in RCM 916-04 the reasons for loss of self-defense. So even if this defense were raised, and we, our primary position is that it was not even raised in the first instance, but even if it were raised, it would not have been available to him as a matter of law.
So if it was raised, he couldn't have gotten an instruction on it? If this were a contested case?
Your Honor, I believe there may be, in a contested case, the trial standard is that it must be some evidence of the defense.
Well, why isn't that all that matters here? That is, if we're in a situation in which we're trying to find out whether the individual has providently pled guilty or not, the choice of the judge at that point is to say, or the choice of the individual at that point, when the judge points out what the problem is to go ahead with trial. And what is the difference between the sum evidence standard for an instruction and the substantial basis for Prater? Or are they different?
I believe they are different, Your Honor. The sum evidence standard, first of all, in most scenarios would be raised by the defense. The defense wants a particular instruction. Issue.
Yeah, what the defense wants here is defense counsel wants his client to be able to make providency in this case. And isn't it up to the judge to pierce through that and figure out whether or not the person is admitting guilt out of their own mouth?
Well, there is some obligation to do that, Your Honor, but I would say that there needs to be some quantum of conflict, and that's why the substantial modifier to that becomes important. This court has said in Prater, on appellate review, there has to be a substantial basis to overturn the plea. At the trial level, it's not exactly clear what the standard is, but I believe there should be some substantial conflict or some substantial inconsistency with the pleas. There are several cases where...
What case would stand for the proposition that if the evidence is sufficient, and I'm not saying that it is here, just we're talking about the proposition here, not the application of his case. If the evidence is sufficient, would be sufficient to warrant an instruction, why doesn't that provide a substantial basis? That is, if a person could go to trial and have the members instructed and have the members return a verdict of not guilty, why isn't that sufficient to overturn the providency of a plea?
For example, United States versus Smith, there was no instructions on self-defense given, and that plea was found improvident. I don't know that there's any specific case where the court has paralleled the sum evidence standard at a contested trial with the what standard it would apply in a guilty plea. Because of the different circumstances in terms of the nature of the plea versus the contested case, the knowledge of the members who have to find those facts and their lack of legal knowledge, here we have a judge who is essentially a finder of fact, although in receiving the pleas, and he knows the law. He doesn't need the instructions. He knows what self-defense means. And as I mentioned in the actual facts, even if this were raised, the facts in this case would not have allowed the accused to avail himself of that defense.
I understand that. Thank you, counsel.
The other issue with this the way that this case is developed is that with this one particular comment, the Coast Guard Court seized upon that as this substantial basis. We see throughout the record that everything else was consistent with each other, and that it was this one particular comment that was offered as a rationalization for his wrongful behavior, and he admitted in his unsworn statement that pushing his wife was wrong. So we would like to characterize that as a rationalization of behavior, not a legal justification for his behavior, and not an affirmative attempt to raise the issue of self-defense. I see that my time has almost expired.
You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the defense.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Commander Nisha Chambliss, and I, with Lieutenant Howard, represent Petty Officer Yanger in this matter. I would like to start this morning by addressing a few of the points that the government made and a couple of questions that the court answered asked, and then we'll proceed to my argument. First, I would like to note that Petty Officer Yanger's answers, in fact, were ambiguous. When he answered the questions about whether or not he felt threatened, whether or not he felt scared, those answers were ambiguous because the military judge had failed to instruct him on the defense of self-defense and what those terms meant and what those requirements were. Petty Officer Yanger didn't understand what threat was necessary under the defense of self-defense or what he needed to be afraid of or
are you, there's so many different pages we use now. Page 3009 in the fifth joint appendix. Are you in the section where the military judge says, when she broke the stem word, did you think that she was threatening you in some way?
I believe that's page 74 of the record, if I recall correctly, Your Honor.
And he says, no, sir, she was, and the judge says she was just angry, accused, yes, sir. And that's where you think it's ambiguous?
That's one of the places, Your Honor.
And state again why no, sir, is ambiguous.
Well, the reason, Your Honor, is because the question itself is ambiguous and the terms are ambiguous in light of his answers. The military judge was trying to really actually was probably asking about self-defense. In fact, at one point he did say something to the effect of, and this is not a quote, do you believe that self-defense applies to you?
And what did he say?
He said no.
He said no.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. He said no.
And what's ambiguous about no?
What's ambiguous is that he didn't understand the defense.
Does the military judge have an obligation to give a dictionary definition of every term that he asked the accused?
Well, Your Honor, not a dictionary definition, but a legal definition.
Do you think she was threatening you somehow gets at the issue of self-defense?
No, Your Honor, not in this case. And the reason is because he didn't need to feel threatened per se. He needed to apprehend bodily harm. And that's different or can be different from feeling threatened.
And you don't think threatening you is, in plain English, an appropriate way to draw out whether he apprehended bodily harm?
No, Your Honor, I don't. And the reason is, as the Coast Guard Corps pointed out, there are several different definitions of the word threat. And the Coast Guard Corps actually put those in their opinion. Petty Officer Yanger could have thought that he needed to feel that his wife was threatening him. And he did not feel that she was threatening him. He didn't think that she was coming after him or was intending to physically harm him.
And why wasn't that ambiguity resolved later when he said, why did you shove her, accused, in the situation I was in, sir, I just wanted her out of my face with the glass? And then they go on with some additional questions.
Yes, Your Honor. Well,
same problem?
Same problem, Your Honor. And in fact, that statement is really obviously the crux of the issue, although we need to look at that statement in light of the totality of the case and the totality of the evidence. We have several pieces of evidence before us, and when you look at the surrounding circumstances, and if I may mention a few of those, Your Honor, his wife had blocked the car that he was in and partially blocked two lanes of traffic. She had broken a piece of stemware on the frame of the car door just above the window that was partially open where he was sitting. He had already been cut by this piece of stemware. They continued to argue.
Well, he was cut when he went to grab for the cell phone where she said she was going to call the command, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
He said it was his own fault.
Well, it was an accident, Your Honor. Yes.
Not anything that she did.
That's correct, Your Honor. She was not, and again, this goes to she was not threatening him physically or trying to hurt him, and he's certainly not saying that. And that's why when he was out.
Then how can he apprehend bodily harm?
Because, Your Honor, he actually had already sustained bodily harm. So.
Well, that's yes, he sustained bodily harm because he grabbed the phone and cut his finger.
Yes, sir.
She didn't contribute to that other than by breaking the stem wire. He did that himself. It was an accidental cut. So how did he, and where in this is enough to raise self-defense?
Well, Your Honor, if you picture what's happening, they are arguing not just in close proximity, but in very close proximity. She has that same piece of stemware still in her hand, and he knows that it's sharp and is capable of inflicting injury. As we know, it's quite capable of inflicting injury. The record says that she was in his face at close proximity, gesturing with a sharp shard that had already cut him. Now, he didn't think that she was going to try to cut him, but the fact that this is waving...
Could he have retreated?
Your Honor, we don't know.
What did he say when I asked?
He was not asked.
He wasn't asked that.
Okay. I'm sorry.
But he wasn't scared and he didn't feel threatened.
He did not feel threatened. And what he said was, in his affidavit, if you look at the language in his affidavit, he said that he thought for self-defense to apply, that he had to be afraid of her and that he had to be afraid for his life. He thought that that's what those questions meant. That's very different from apprehending bodily harm. Apprehending bodily harm could mean simply, I'm anticipating that I may be cut by this glass that's waving very close to me.
But doesn't it have to have, it's not just enough that he's apprehending that someone is waving a glass and that he might get his arm in the way and get hurt. It has to be that he apprehends that someone else is going to inflict harm on him.
Your Honor, I don't believe that there's an element of intent required on the part of the other person. He simply has to...
What about was about to be inflicted wrongfully on the accused? If she's waving the glass around and he gets his arm in the way, how is that wrongfully? How is that her doing anything to him?
Well, Your Honor, it could have been that it was negligent on her part. There are a lot of different ways that could have happened. And Your Honor... All of these details in terms of this defense, part of the reason we have so many questions is because the military judge...
But what did he do wrong? I mean, he's listened to the entire Providency inquiry. The accused has made a stray comment. He asks sufficient questions to realize that there's no other questions to be asked. I mean, he said one thing. He made one comment. The judge has the entire Providency inquiry, the stipulation of fact, all of which make clear that the appellant is decrying any fear, any apprehension, any suggestion that the wife is attacking him in any way.
Your Honor, Petty Officer Yanger is not saying that his wife is trying to attack him, but the military judge's questions were not sufficient, and it was not merely the one comment that raised the defense. It's the totality of the circumstances. When you look at all of the things that had happened that evening and all of the other evidence in the case put together with that statement, that's what, when you set that picture up, you recognize it's very reasonable for him to apprehend bodily harm. So he was apprehending bodily harm, or could have been apprehending bodily harm.
Could have. Isn't that this mere possibility?
No, you're, well, no.
Okay,
you're
first. What standard does CCA apply here?
Well, Your Honor, the CCA applied the appropriate standard.
What is the appropriate standard?
A possibility of a defense was raised, and that resulted in a substantial conflict, which under Prater, substantial conflict to oath so that the guilty plea should...
Under Prater, the mere possibility isn't enough.
Right.
You've got to have a substantial conflict. The CCA's statement that the record is replete with statements that address the possibility of self-defense that's lingering at the fringes,
yes,
seems to be replete with mere possibility rather than any substantial conflict.
Your Honor, yes, mere possibility is not sufficient, but a possible defense is sufficient in the cases that where these have been overturned.
How does that raise the substantial conflict required by Prager?
Well, Your Honor, because a possible defense is in itself a substantial conflict.
If there's a possibility, it's by definition substantial. That seems to be what you're saying.
If there's not just a mere possibility.
That seems to eviscerate Prater.
No, Your Honor. There's a difference, and it is it's a difficult distinction to make. But
please make it.
Your Honor, the cases distinguish between a mere possibility versus a possible defense. And
how does this rise above a mere possibility? The language the CCA itself uses seems replete with mere possibility.
No, Your Honor. The language is not mere possibility. The language is that a possible defense was raised, and the Coast Guard Court found that that defense was raised. And again, they noted many, many different factors.
So was defense counsel ineffective for agreeing to the stipulation of fact then? Is that what you're arguing, in effect?
Your Honor, we're not arguing
go ahead.
That counsel was ineffective.
So counsel signs off on a stipulation of fact that's used for the inquiry where it says Yanger was not acting in self-defense. That's effective representation if you're arguing self-defense today?
Your Honor, we have not raised the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel.
So how do you deal with paragraph 30 of the stipulation?
Yes, Your Honor.
I guess your argument is the judge should nonetheless have opened up paragraph 30 based on the responses.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. A legal conclusion by Pastor Yanger is not sufficient. Regarding ineffective assistance.
Well, that thing wasn't signed alone. Signed by Yanger, but it was signed by his defense counsel, was it not?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the military judgment over every paragraph of the stipulation of fact with the appellant, and he agreed that all the facts that were contained in it were correct and true and accurate.
Yes, Your Honor. He did. That said, Your Honor, it is still important and actually mandatory that a military judge establish on the record an adequate basis in law and fact to uphold the guilty plea. And it's not enough.
So which element of the offense that we're talking about today is not supported by the Providence inquiry and the stipulation of fact?
Well, Your Honor, this is not a question of whether each element was met. This is a question of whether the defense of self-defense was raised. But as was mentioned in U.S. v. Inabinette, it's possible for all the elements to be met and yet a plea to not be provident if a defense was raised. And that's what we have here, where there was a legal matter that was raised, and the Petty Officer Yanger's blanket statements that self-defense did not apply are insufficient. He was not savvy enough to make those legal determinations. And regardless of what his defense counsel did or did not do, it's still incumbent upon the military judge to resolve those matters on the record. It's required by RCM 90, it's required by Article 45. The military judge has a duty to resolve these matters on the record.
Was Petty Officer Yanger of particularly low intelligence?
There's nothing
in the record that reflects anything about his intelligence.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
No, Your Honor. But again, Your Honor, the concept of self-defense can be a fairly complicated one. RCM 916E has three separate paragraphs applying to different situations in different levels of force. It appears, and we don't know this because, again, the military judge failed to establish enough facts on the record for us to know, but it appears that Petty Officer Yanger may have been thinking he needed needed to meet the requirements under RCM 916E1 rather than 916E1.
Are you suggesting he read the RCM and teased it out?
My guess is that he probably did not, Your Honor, and that's precisely the problem, is that he had a layman's, if even a layman's, understanding of self-defense. And he said in his affidavit he thought he needed to
be. So his defense counsel didn't explain it to him when he had him sign paragraph 30?
Your Honor, we don't know what his defense counsel explained to him. And again, Your Honor, regardless of what his counsel explained to him, it's incumbent upon the military judge to elicit those facts on the record again. The same would be true, similarly, with the elements. We could not have a stipulation of fact where the accused just said, I meet the elements, and okay. I sign on the bottom and rely on the defense counsel.
Well, counsel, let's leave this case aside and just let me ask you a general question. If someone in a Providence inquiry says, I wasn't afraid and I wasn't being attacked, how is the defense of self-defense raised?
Because, Your Honor, fear is not what's required. It's apprehension. And it's apprehension just of bodily harm. And that can be different. A person can be apprehending bodily harm but not necessarily be afraid of that. He'd already been cut. So he may be thinking, as she's waving the glass, I'm about to be cut. I need to put some distance between my face and this sharp piece of glass. It doesn't mean, and one possible explanation is he's a tough guy and doesn't want to admit that he was scared or wasn't scared in the heat of the argument. That wasn't his overriding emotion. So fear is not what we're looking at, and that's why those questions by the military judge about feeling threatened, feeling afraid, were insufficient. It's apprehension.
Don't we want the military judge in a situation like this to speak colloquially with the accused before determining whether a legal definition is required?
Your Honor, yes. I mean, speaking to the accused in a manner in which he understands is critically important, absolutely. The accused needs to understand what's being asked. But the military judge also has to be accurate, and that's a difficult thing to do. Had the military judge asked, after he answered the question, why did you shove her? I just wanted, in the situation that I was in, I just wanted her out of my face with the glass. The military judge could have said, why?
Well, he did. He said, did you feel threatened? Did you feel scared?
But, Your Honor,
he should ask, why?
That would have helped. I don't know that would have been sufficient, but that certainly would have helped.
But why you're also relying on the overall atmospherics, is that fair to say?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You're relying on atmospherics and not just the yes and no answers to the judge.
Well, the answers to the other evidence in the case and the situation, the fact that he
the whole context.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And the Coast Guard Court recognized that as well. They said this is not just this one statement. It's all of these other pieces put together that raise the...
Lurking at the fringes.
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah.
If this had been a contested case and all the evidence presented at trial consisted of the material presented in the Providence inquiry, that is the stipulation and the dialogue with the judge, and the accused repeatedly said that he did not feel threatened, did not feel afraid, military judge in a contested case, if the military judge in a contested case did not give a self-defense instruction, what would be the result on appeal?
Your Honor, we would argue that we would have the same problem, that they needed to have that instruction under Deering, the some evidence standard, that instruction should have been given and that the members should have had the opportunity to ask Petty Officer Yanger.
Even with repeated statements about not being scared and not being threatened?
Yes, Your Honor. Those statements are insufficient because Petty Officer Yanger didn't understand what those meant. And again, he has an affidavit describing that. The other thing that we would like to address is that the defense was available. The government has asserted that this was mutual combat. We have not been able to find a case where a war of words was sufficient to be mutual combat. Again, whether or not there was mutual combat, whether or not the appellant was an aggressor, these are all factual issues that were not developed on the record because the military judge did not ask those questions and did not go down the path that he had started. It was very clear that all of the parties involved believed that self-defense was at issue. The military judge actually asked about self-defense. Self-defense was in the stipulation. The parties all thought self-defense was at issue, and yet the military judge failed in his duty to simply explain the defense and establish enough information on the record to put that aside and to resolve the issue. The evidence is very clear that that self-defense was raised, that Petty Officer Yanger's plea was not provident because of the issue of self-defense. The decision of the Coast Guard Court should be upheld and affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. Does the government have rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Your Honor, I'd like to first invite the court's attention to the Joint Appendix, page 38 or page 73 of the original record of trial, regarding whether or not the judge asked the accused if he could have retreated. The military judge said, could you have just walked away? The accused said, yes, sir. I'd also like to broadly restate our arguments here. The broader legal concept that we're raising initially is that there may have been a mere possibility of defense, but the defense was not raised as this court has required. There was not a substantial conflict. And then more fact specific to this case, if the defense was raised, it would not have been available. So the remedy of setting aside the pleas just is illogical. For those reasons, unless there are further questions from the court, I respectfully request that you reverse the opinion of the court below.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. Court will stand in recess until 9:45 a.m.